Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Bro, I mean, I want to talk about your journey over lunch later, but like, because what, just hearing Bao speak at the, you know,
yeah,
and then hearing Hong telling me about like all your 66 night market food ideas, I'm like, what?
Oh, you didn't?
I didn't know any of that. Cause I was just raving about the pho taco. I was like, oh, how fun, you know? And it was good. And then Hong was like, oh, you didn't know he had all these like concepts at a 66 night market.
Oh.
And like, I was like, damn, I gotta talk to you about that.
That's why I appreciate what you do so much.
Yeah.
You know, I look at the work that you do and I know how much hard work goes into these things. You know, they just don't magically appear.
Yeah. I mean, well, it takes somebody in foods to recognize the effort in food, you know, so. But yeah, it's tight, and I don't know, I just genuinely want to, because like from, like for me, I like to help hoi, you know,
yeah.
Like in through conversation, I like to ask, like see what your journey was about, and then where it took you, and like how you got there, how you got into foods, and you know, from a different industry too,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I thought that was cool, as you know, something that we're going to talk about over lunch.
Well, first of all, thank you for sitting through a second part of our podcast. You know, part two.
I was kidding. No. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And then the second part is thanks for coming up last Saturday.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure to see you at the event and you and Julia having fun. You know?
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. It was really cool to see all the faces in the communities from the different niches and fields and just coming together. And it gave me a sense of pride. Well, first of all, being in Reno for the past 6-7 years is like, I don't get to be exposed to these events, you know, or just being able to come around community events. So just being there, I was telling Julia while we were just standing, snacking, I was like, damn, like this is really cool because it's, you know, it's people from different industries and like, seeing other food content creators, seeing, Vietnamese comedians and, you know, the speech that Bao gave, was impactful because it did give you a sense of pride, or I hope it did to other people, but it left me with a sense of pride of like being Vietnamese. And when Bao lists off like, you know, different accomplishments, different Vietnamese that has accomplished something in the industry, the, you know, the bigger market, I was like, damn, okay, we're gonna be next.
Yeah.
You know, it like, you know, it's like, let's continue to thrive and do what we do best, and then we're gonna be next to make that mark. You know?
Well, let me ask you, what do you see as being next in the mainstream market for you?
I think having a brick and mortar, transition from social media to brick and mortar and really make an impact, because right now social media for me, it's somewhat of an impact, but I feel like that brick and mortar, just being able to physically feed people versus helping people with recipes, I want to be able to, like, you know, feed people and express my, or cook the food that I want to cook in person,
yeah,
so that people can actually taste it. Because on social media, I can be as creative as possible, right? I can make like a really creative dish, but if no one's going to get to taste it, no food critic gets to taste it, then, or no one in the community gets to taste it, they're not going to be able to really critique it, or like, okay, he's doing something with Vietnamese cuisine, or he's doing something with Vietnamese food. Visually, maybe yes. Visually, if they're watching it on their phone or YouTube or TikTok, then they're like, okay, that's cool, but we don't know how, like, what it tastes like.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the next step for me is just being able to take, just transition from social media to brick and mortar.
Yeah.
And then from there onwards.
It's like in Vietnamese, we say thử lửa.
Yeah.
And you test your fire, see, test it under fire and see what the response is, right? Yeah. But damn, it's such a hard journey to have a brick and mortar and to run it and to manage it.
It's It's hard to, I'll say this, yes, it's hard, period. It's one of the toughest business to operate is the food business, but I think it's the challenge, right? It's, I think if I'm looking back through my previous journeys is I always run towards hard, right? Moving to Vietnam with barely a penny in my pocket was hard. Moving to San Francisco with, you know, little to knowledge of if I'm gonna get the job at
Venue
is hard. You know, it's like we always chase our hard because through that hard is how we grow, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you, like, without pressure, there's no diamond.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. And it's the hero's journey and the catharsis that comes from, you know, the process of going through fire.
Yeah, I think in conversation I was talking to Julia the other day, it's like we're the only species that do the opposite of what our nature tells us to do, which is our nature is we're supposed to be in comfort, be safe, like seek safety and all that stuff. But we're the only creature to pursue, you know, pursue hard, get out there. And like, because I told her, like, that's the only way we'll grow and how we will evolve as a species, you know. So
well, let's get into the content creation, because it is really fascinating to me to think about the process of what dish to put together. But even more so than that is, how do we know that what you're doing is, God, I hate this word, not authentic.
Yeah.
But how do you know that what you're picking is something that is reflecting a sense of the country, of Vietnam, of the tradition?
See, and that's the word authentic is a word to debate on, you know, because, and this is my opinion and my belief, and I'll stand strong on it, and is that, what is authentic Vietnamese cuisine? You know, because our cuisine, Vietnamese cuisine, the philosophy of it is always, the philosophy of Vietnamese cuisine is always taking what is available and adjusting it to your palate, to the Vietnamese palate, right? And using the techniques you learn and adjusting that to the palate. For example, back in the days, like just reading from all the cookbooks I read, it's like, how was pho created?
Yeah.
How was banh mi created? You know, it's taking the influence that were around us and adjusting that to our palate. It's Vietnamese cooks sharing kitchens with French cooks in families of aristocrats and exchanging ideas of like, okay, I see this guy making a pot au pho, you know, and then taking Chinese influence and adding noodles and now adjusting that to the Vietnamese palate, then you have pho. Or for banh mi, for example, you have French cooks back then using baguettes, pâtés, and Vietnamese cooks like, wait a minute, we love these flavors, but we could take that influence and use it for our palate, you know? So to answer your question is, I keep the integrity of the dish, but in terms of ingredients, flavor, I still keep the integrity of the Vietnamese palate. But I can't say my food is authentic. I can say my food is Vietnamese because I'm using what's available to me, but I'm keeping the flavor profile that's Vietnamese. And the integrity of the dish, like, so if, for example, if I were to say, can you name me what would be the identity of banh mi? Can you list out the ingredients of, if you look at that sandwich, you'll recognize, oh, that's about me.
Yeah.
Are you able to just instantly like name those
ingredients? Are you asking me right
yes.
now? Yeah, I can.
Yeah,
you want
right?
me to do it right now?
Yeah. Please.
So, yeah, yeah, yeah. So obviously there's banh mi and some like, you know, it's rugged,
yeah.
deformed baguette form, right?
Yeah.
Some shortcut or whatever influenced that. So it's the baguette. It's the mayo, but it's not really mayo, but it's like hand whipped oil and eggs,
yeah.
right? And with some seasoning like salt or whatever.
Yeah.
There's pate, there's cold cuts, if there's cold cuts, and there's pickles,
yeah.
right? And cilantro and...
Yeah, so that's what I mean by the integrity, the identity yeah. of a dish, right? Because
you know that
like
there's,
yeah. you know what's in that dish to make that, or the ingredients
yeah.
in that dish to make that dish. For example, like the pickled carrots and daikon,
yeah.
that's very notable to a banh mi,
yeah.
right? The cilantro, jalapenos can be the same.
Yeah.
I mean, like the variation varies, but once you see those ingredients, you'll recognize yeah. that it's a banh mi,
yeah.
right? So the ingredients can always change. It doesn't have to always be a cold cut. It could be a banh mi thịt nướng, or if, for example, if you're in an area where thịt isn't available, meat isn't available, you can use fish,
yeah.
right? You can use fish.
Sardines.
Yeah. Right? So that's what I mean by my philosophy
yeah.
in Vietnamese cuisine is using what's available but adjust it to the Vietnamese palate.
Yeah.
So I can't say the food that I post is quote unquote authentic. I'm using the ingredients that is available to me and is available to the people who follow my recipe. And I'm adjusting when I write these recipes, I'm writing it to the Vietnamese palate. Yes, so
yeah.
I hope that answered your question.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally. I've been saying some pretty crazy things on this podcast recently when it comes to food, right?
Yeah.
Like OC has the best, and you know, yeah. and I say it tongue in cheek, but I also mean it. But there's nuances to everything.
Yeah.
But I also think that Vietnamese cuisine has the most variety. Like
yes.
if you think about the hundreds of dishes and variations and noodles and banh mi and stews and pho.
Yeah.
There is so much variation. Do you know of any other culture that can compare to the amount of maybe Chinese food? But I mean, beyond that, I don't even think Chinese food has as much
we
do.
They're very strict in terms. I mean, I can't speak on it because I haven't ventured out there yet. But it really comes down to the philosophy of Vietnamese cuisine. And right now I have people like when I make... For example, recently I shared a gan chua recipe, but gan chua, yes, it's known to have gan chua,
yeah.
right? But using the ingredients, with mm-hmm. the philosophy of using the ingredients that are available to you, it's, well, some people don't like gan, right? So
yeah.
I use shrimp, I share shrimp. Most of my following base is American, African-American. So I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna share catfish because it's off-putting, or
yeah.
it could leave a grassy taste if it's not prepared right. So I'm gonna do shrimp. So when I did shrimp for that gan chua recipe, oh man, people on TikTok were saying that's not authentic. There's no such thing as gan chua thumb, but you know, it's like, oh, gan chua is supposed to be made with catfish, gan chua cat, right? But like, if you think about it, the philosophy of Vietnamese cuisine, and I'll keep repeating this, it's using what you have available, but it's still a gan chua. At the end of the
right.
day, it's still a gan chua dish. Yeah. It's just a different protein. And Vietnamese cuisine, because of that philosophy, because of the philosophy of using what's available to you and creating, adjusting to the Vietnamese palate, till this day, at this very moment in Vietnam, there are new dishes being created
right.
and sold on the streets that people do not know about. And people can't say, oh, that's not authentic, or this is not authentic Vietnamese, because what is authentic Vietnamese, right? What, you have cheese, thơm nướng phô mai in
yeah,
the streets of Vietnam
new.
Right now. Cheese is not
authentic
to Vietnam, right? But people eat it up. Hào nướng phô mai
mm-hmm.
or... I don't know, it's just
ban
a
jang,
lot.
Ban yeah,
jang
nung
is
yeah.
just new techniques, like people like just adapting, but to the Vietnamese palate. Now it's Vietnamese because you're using Vietnamese flavors and you're cooking it to, you're adjusting it to the palate. Now it's Vietnamese, right? And the reason why I make ganchio tteum was because I had it at a Vietnamese restaurant. It was a combo that they serve. It's actually at a restaurant called Tan Mi. They serve ganchio tteum with gai kho do, right? So I was inspired by that. So that's why I make
ganchio tteum. You mean the old school Tan Mi?
The old school Tan Mi on both
sides. Is that a new dish that they have?
It's not new. It's so they have options of ganchio gai and ganchio tteum. So because I got gai kho, so I just want to switch it up to, wow, you know, tteum in my ganchio. But the argument on TikTok is that, you know, there are people who stand behind that Vietnamese cuisine is different in different regions.
Yeah.
You know, like even from house to house, yeah, is different because each family has different palates. But yeah, Vietnamese food is going to be different in the States. It's going to be different in Germany, in France, because Vietnamese people are using what's available to, yeah, them and adjusting it to their Vietnamese palate. Yeah, so once again, I hope they answer your question. It's a lot.
Yeah, no, it does. And how do you normally respond to these trolls or these comments? Maybe not trolls.
Not trolls.
Heavy word.
They're diehard. It's people are used to what they are used to. If you grew up and you're used to a dish, if you're used to a dish being made a certain way, of course you're going to stand behind it, which no fault to them. Right?
How do you respond though?
I don't reply.
Oh, like, you don't?
There will be one of these days where I will have to make a video and really explain and say what I just told you about the philosophy of Vietnamese cuisine.
Or you can just do it right now.
Or just use this right clip, yeah, you know? But I don't reply. Yeah. I let other people reply because, yeah, other people do. And if you go on TikTok, like, there are people who, like, and it's in Vietnamese too. Like, people like, này là không phải giống như là ganchua phải có cá, or it's like không có tôm. And then there will be people from Vietnam like mỗi món mỗi nhà khác nhau. Like, each house is like different. Like, they cook to their own palate. They cook to what's available to them. You know. So yeah, but most of the time I don't reply. Yeah. Because I know what's right. I'm not gonna. Well, I mean, maybe what I know isn't right.
But it's right for you.
It's right for me, right? Like, at the end of the day, cuisine is to each their own.
Yeah.
You know, a cook could make a dish differently than how, you know, it's like everybody's different, you know, but it's right for me. I know that it still has the sweetness, the sourness of ganchuo. It has, if I were to serve you that bowl of soup and I didn't tell you what it is, if you taste it, if you look at the ingredients visually, you'll know it's ganchuo, except it's with them.
Yeah.
Right? But will it still nourish you? Will it still give you joy if I were to feed you that bowl of ganchuo with gai kho do and just a pot of steaming hot rice? Like, you'll still say it's ganchuo, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly. Because it's like, if it tastes like it, if it looks like it, but the proteins are different, then it's still ganchuo.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
But I'm sure you can go back in the history of Vietnam like 40, 50, 80 years ago and find somebody in the Delta that did it with tteum.
Oh, for
sure.
You
know what I mean? So it's
for sure. Because that's the thing about our people and our cuisine is... We're always playing with things.
Right.
And that's the thing with cuisine too. If we're not playing around with ingredients and mixing and matching, how do we come up with new dishes and new variations? And, you know, so like, how can we have, like, bánh tráng nướng in the street is fairly new.
Yeah.
Right? Because one day somebody decided to take a piece of rice paper and started grilling over charcoal and putting like condiments on it. Now it's like, it's a well-known dish. If somebody didn't take cheese, pho mai, and grill it with tteum, you never have pho mai nướng tteum. It's such an interesting combination to think about, but it works for people. People love it and they eat it up, you know? So that's the philosophy behind Vietnamese cuisine and just how playful the Vietnamese people are with ingredients.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the progression in the last few years? And this is really for me because I'm greedy for knowledge.
Yeah.
And I want to know what it felt like when you first started shooting the food to where you are now. Can you tell me about the sort of the visual progression, the visual style, the improvements, the iterations along the way, that whole journey? I'm so curious about how you go about, like, okay, I'm going to just start shooting. And then finally you have this, like, today, the most recent ones are polished.
Yeah.
And, you know, perhaps we could talk about in the future where you want to go further with it. But yeah. I want to hear the whole iteration process.
And to start that off, I will say that up until the transition into content, my whole persona, ego, and personality has been, like, head down in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Quiet, just work, right? I wasn't trained to be in front of a camera. I really didn't know how to put together a food video. So it started with me just looking at other videos of seeing what people are doing, right? And in the early days of Instagram Reels and TikTok, people were speaking really fast. Reason being is because when it was first released, the early days, you only have 15 seconds.
Wow.
Right now, a minute on Instagram or a minute and 30 seconds is a luxury because you get to tell your story or you get to explain the dish within a minute and 30 seconds, right? So I had 15 seconds and then eventually it led into 30 seconds. And then it stayed at 30 second limit for a while. So I had to fit everything in. So if, and I leave those videos up till this day, even though, like, it makes me cringe, I'm like, damn, like, who the hell is that guy? But wow. I still leave it up so that people are able to scroll and see the progression of growth, to so that people can see, oh, he didn't start off like this. Like, it, like, it took him being cringy and speaking fast. Like, my manager would tell me to slow down. Well, I didn't have a manager in the early days, but, like, when I did have a manager, he was like, slow down. You know, because I'm trying to fit so much information, so much steps into, like, a 30-second video. But, yeah, it started with me just speaking really fast, screaming into the camera, thinking, like, I have to be this like, Gordon Ramsay personality.
Yeah.
I grew up in the YouTube era where there was vlogging and people were just shouting into the camera, like, hey, what's going on, guys? Like, you know, I don't know if you ever seen those clips, but, like, that was the era that I was raised in terms of social media. So that's what I absorbed. Yeah. So I thought that I have to project that same energy into my food videos, you know? And yes, it's very cringy to look back, but at the time I was in a learning process. You know, I was learning how to compose myself in front of a camera. I was learning how to get, you know, the shot and of the food. And it was tough at first, but, and till this day, I tell everybody that I'm still in the process of nailing down or just quote unquote mastering my style.
Yeah.
Like, I still don't have a style yet. There's different styles.
How do you even say that? How can you say that you don't have a style yet?
It's crazy. I mean, I can't, I do, but I don't. Like, there's not one style that I'm consistently putting out. There's speaking into the camera, but in order to do so, maybe, and right now I'm still by myself. As you can see, I film by myself. I do my own lighting, own editing and all that stuff. So in order for me to maybe speak into the camera more naturally and focus on the food and not mess up on the food as well.
Yeah.
I would need a shooter, somebody behind the camera, but because I'm shooting the videos myself and adjusting the camera angles all the time, the style that works best for me is voiceovers. The transition was difficult at first, but eventually, and I guess there was an audience back then for the fast-paced videos, like the next add minced garlic, blah, 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 blah. Like, there was an audience for that.
That's why people consumed it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here today.
Exactly. So there was an audience for that. But then eventually, the market just became so saturated with that style of content of people speaking so fast or, like, just crazy jump cuts of just ASMR. Now people are geared towards, they're more attracted towards storytelling, like slowing down the pace. So now, as you see in my content, I'm more calm. My energy is more calm in these videos. I focus on the food and the story behind the food. And that's what does well. But it's something I'm still trying to improve. and something I'm still trying to work on.
So for the future, when you see a goalpost down the line, downstream, what do you see that you need to work on to be your best self as it refers to content creation?
Making enough money to have a camera full, or a camera operator full time.
Yeah.
A camera operator full time that's able to get the angles I want and just know my style and just work the camera for me. If I could just take that weight off of my shoulders and just focus solely on cooking and being myself, I think that would just drastically change the game for me.
And why do you think that having that level of production will create more engagement?
Because I get to be more natural, and then people just want to see people being themselves.
Yeah.
They don't want to see this, well, and I'm sure you can see in my content from the past, if you look at it, it's like I was this very rigid, robotic, militarized, like, because from the past with ROTC, like,
yeah,
just, you know, like the kitchen pass as well is just militarized, like delivery. Like, but if I could just slow down and just tell that story, be myself without like just worrying so much if I were to mess up, you know, yeah, like, or to mess up like a part of the videos, because it happens so many times where I forgot to hit the record button and I'm so focused on the food where the audio, like sometimes I would go through a whole audio, like a whole video, and realize my mic wasn't on. Right? So there's so many times, and it's a lot. And I think that just having that one change would just switch up the game for me, because, and I think that's what people want at the end of the day, is just because the market is so saturated because with so many food content creators, and that people just want to somebody that they can relate to and connect to. You know, it's like anybody could, you know, whip out their phone, or anybody could go on Google and type up a recipe and then cook and film that video and just tell people how to make it, right? But it's the story, the creator of why you're making that video is what people are attracted to. And I think to be able to get there is going to change the game for me.
I was telling you earlier, I was talking to a podcast host and a book editor. His name is Francis Lam.
Yeah.
He hosts The Splendid Table. And I was asking him, in his early days, he went to CIA. And he was telling me about how he got started. He sent out these emails to his friends and family, and then an editor at a big New York magazine picked up. And he became, they would go to him for articles and for beats and stuff like that. And I go, well, what is the driving force of like a good story or article?
Yeah.
And he broke it down to me where, because you're telling me that not only do you need the production value, but now you need to be you, you need to have a story. But he said something really interesting. It's sort of like the film industry where there needs to be tension.
Yeah.
But how would you create that in a cooking video, right?
Yeah.
But he said the thing that makes these food articles happen and come alive is, you know, a personal story.
Yeah.
But this idea of tension that you set up, you know, the first part and you create like a problem, and then give people that solution.
So I do carry that in the video somewhat, in, you know, it's just like of the story I tell too, is like nowadays it's like I would share my experience with the dish and then leave tips, because the experience that I have could be somebody's problem. For example, like the recent one that blew up like crazy on all platforms was just a simple chicken stock, like a very chicken forward chicken stock. And the problem is, or the problem that the tension I presented was that, that, you know, and usually chicken stock are very cloudy because people just overboils the fat in the chicken bowl, or, you know, like people don't remove the fat, or they leave the fat in, which just leads to a cloudy stock. That's the problem. And then after that, I went into giving people the tips of how to make a clear stock.
Yeah.
And the stock that I made or film was a Vietnamese style stock, or a stock that I was raised and taught by my mom how to make it, versus the chicken stock that I was taught how to make in culinary school. Yeah. So I don't know, that was the tension for people.
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh,
clearly.
The tension was like, oh man, the stock in culinary school or French style stock is way different from a Vietnamese style stock. And then I just gave people all like just tips and solutions of how they can achieve the same stock. And then maybe that's why it did, like it blew up the way it did. Yeah. But
Let's get into this stock thing, this stock business.
Yeah.
I don't understand why Vietnamese moms are so damn obsessed with clear stock. What is this?
I don't think it's just Vietnamese mom. It's just aesthetic throughout all kitchens. It's just, it's...
You mean in other cultures too?
In other cultures too, like even French, like the, like in fine dining kitchens, like you're like, when I'm straightening out, like at the French Laundry, when I'm straightening out a stock, like I was told to like be gentle when I'm passing the stock through a fine mesh strainer, a chinois, like just be gentle, because usually, and it will go through a couple of strains too. It's not just
one.
It's not just one strain. Yeah. So the first strain is, so back at the French Laundry, we have a veal stock and sometimes a chicken stock. And the first strain is through a China cap with bigger holes just to remove the bones, right? But then the second, third, fourth strain is through two chinois, two fine mesh strainers that we stack on top of each other, and we just pass continuously, but gently, so that, you know, the impurities doesn't come down to like four times just to get that clear stock. But it's a sign of care. It's a sign of care. Because I think in foods, if you're consuming a product, if you're consuming a dish, and there are nuances that you could point out that shows that the person who prepared this dish cared, then you know that dish is going to be good.
But look, I want what's in the impurities. I think, doesn't that add to the flavor profile? Like if we're straining the shit out of these things, it's like, well, what are we left with at the end of the day, if it's all clear?
If the stock is made right, the flavor is in the stock, not in the impurities. Yeah, so like the impurities that's in the stock is just left over, like all the myoglobins, you know, the coagulated proteins, but it's just the flavor should be in the stock and not in the impurity is my answer. But it's, at the end of the day, I think it's a sign of care.
Yeah.
It shows care. That's why professional kitchens are obsessed with it. That's why all the Vietnamese moms are obsessed with it, because it shows that they can make a stock. It's what is the standard between the Vietnamese mom communities, that's the standard. You know, like if you know how Vietnamese parents are, or you know, even my mom, even if we were to go out to eat at a Vietnamese restaurant and you see something, they'll just they didn't strain properly, or they overboiled their stock, and you know, now it's cloudy, and like they'll just point, like for my mom, she'll just point out all these things that, you know, they didn't do right. But yeah, it's a sign of care.
I have never thought of this.
Yeah.
Thank you for illuminating it. I don't know if I agree entirely with, I understand the care part, right?
Yeah.
I get that. I agree, and I can see that point. But I don't know. I'm having a hard time agreeing with this idea of having such a filtered broth. Because do people do that with pho broth?
Yes and no. And I could tell you now that the most popular pho restaurant in OC, they don't do it because they pump out so much volume.
How could you?
They just, man, if you look in the kitchen of Pho-holic, they'll have like 4, 5, 6, 7 pots just lined up against the wall, just constantly boiling. But you know, at the end of the day, if the flavor is there, if the flavor is right, then sure, you know, then serve it. But it's the taking care of the stock, straining it so much is just a form of finesse. It's just adding finesse to.
So do you strain your pho stock?
I do. My, oh, that one actually went viral as well, because the opening clip was like a super clean, clear pour, a ladle pour of the broth, and it was just clear, like a clear brown stock.
And how much?
Only strained it once.
One time.
Yeah. But that, man, but it just took care. Like, I was careful when I poured the bowl.
Dude, I feel like I've been living under a rock.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Because I, you know, I've never strained my pho.
Yeah.
My mom didn't strain it.
You don't have to each their own, you know?
But she always talks about, like, clear broth, right? Yeah. And I just never realized the importance of it until, like, right now. I'm like,
It's a sign of finesse. It's a sign of care. And it's a sign. It's a sign to whoever is eating your dish. Show that. So when you ask people, man, what's the secret ingredient to this dish? Because it's so good, right? And then you tell them all the secret, or people would joke around and say the secret ingredient is love, right?
Got it.
Did you put love into this dish? Yeah. Like so
effort.
Effort, care, finesse, right? So if you serve me a bowl of pho and I see that it's cloudy, or I see that, you know, there's still impurities, bones and stuff, like just floating around, like small bits and stuff like that. I was like, well, if you didn't care enough to strain the stock, did you care enough to season the meat properly? Or like, you know, it just leads on to other things, you know? So that's why I think Vietnamese moms care so much about that, because it just is the first impression of, like, you know.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat.
I worked with a Japanese chef for a year when I first got really into the food business. And now that you're talking about all this stuff, I'm like, wait a minute.
Oh, and Japanese chefs, they care.
They care.
Like every minute detail. Yeah. It's that love that you're putting. It's that love that you're putting into your craft. Yeah.
That technical side that they have is like, I'm just like, what? Why are we doing all this?
And you know, but there's a reason.
Yeah.
There's a reason.
Just to always fight back about that. It's like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Not to you, but in their minds, there's like the steps. Like, they're probably like five steps ahead of like thinking of how that would affect the dish versus from your perspective.
Yeah. So I made a video recently about gelatinizing pho.
Yeah.
And now that I'm talking to you, I'm like, if you strain that thing a few times, are you still going to get it to gelatinize?
Yeah.
You will.
Well, because the gelatin is already melted. It is already in the broth. Like, you're saying, like, oh, all the flavors are all in the impurities. The flavors are in the broth. And, man, I'll show you the B-roll of the clip of the pho. Like, even though that I strain. So my process is, after it's done, I strain it, cool it down. There's a layer of fat. I would chill it. I would chill it overnight in the fridge, let the stock gelatinize. And then that the fat layer solidifies. And then I scoop out. The fat, or that's how I separate it easier. So now my stock is clean and clear, and fat is served to whoever prefers.
An option now.
It is an option, because there are people who prefers their bowl of pho fat free, you know, because they're watching their cholesterol or whatever. So I serve that as an option, but yes, it's still gelatinized.
Yeah. Let me ask you, when you think about a pho, is an easy thing to kind of like use as an example. When you think about a bowl of pho that you make at home versus a bowl of pho that we eat in a restaurant, what is the cost of each bowl of pho that you make at home? And then compare that to like what we're eating outside for like a $15 bowl. Like, I always say it's impossible. Because if you make a bowl of pho at home and it's a $15 bowl, that's a $60 bowl in retail, right?
Yeah.
Do you ever make a $15 bowl for yourself and your family at home?
It probably costs more.
Like, I think shit.
Yeah, like at home is like you're more. Well, when I'm cooking for my family, I'm using premium ingredients.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Versus out in the restaurant where they're cutting costs by using, for example,
bouillon.
Yeah. Right. Restaurants, because they have the volume, because they have the space, because they have the equipment to be able to, you know, pump out what they pump out, because they have meat slicers, they are able to get away with charging that price. But yeah, when I'm cooking for my family, I splurge on ingredients.
Damn, I can't imagine what a $20, $30 bowl of pho by you at home would be like.
Oh, at a restaurant, I don't. Yeah.
That's like a, yeah, if you do a $30 bowl at home, like with the all of the, yeah, the finest ingredients, yeah, and you come up with a $30 bowl of pho from what you pay for the ingredients at home, yeah, that's, yeah, like a $100 bowl of pho easily.
Easily, but then, I mean, at home, I get to play around with more, you know, but in defense of restaurants, they don't get to do that because they're like being mindful of costs, you know, and they're being mindful of their margins.
Yeah.
So they aren't able to do that. But at home, I get to play around more. And, you know, for example, if you go, for example, my pho, I like to serve it with a plate of carpaccio.
Oh.
A plate of
beef carpaccio.
Yeah, beef carpaccio. For example, if you go to a pho restaurant, you call for a bowl of pho with rare steak on the side. So pho, thai ring, right? So that's your plain meat, just plain meat. You could maybe, if you ask for extra limes at the restaurant, you can maybe make your own carpaccio with, you know, squeezing lime on top. But at home, it's like, I basically took all the condiments from all the condiments that you would put in a bowl of pho, which is hanyam and everything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and just make a plate of beef carpaccio to have with your pho. It's like, to have that experience at a restaurant is completely different. And I served it, I think the first time Julia came over, that's what I made for her, was pho with a plate of beef carpaccio. And you're not able to find that at any Vietnamese restaurant locally because...
You can't, yeah. The food costs would be just astronomical on the labor side.
It's just, it's that, but they're not thinking about it as well. They're not thinking about that.
But that's a fusion idea as well.
Yeah, because carpaccio is not even Vietnamese. Yeah, but then, but we it do works. It. Dai jan is something that we do.
Yeah.
Right? Eating pho with thai ring is something that we already do. So it's like, you kind of just pinpoint, okay, we're already doing this, but there's a well-known technique or a well-known dish called carpaccio. So now you're just combining the two, but you're using ingredients that is familiar to us and then adjusting it to our palate, right? So if I were to serve you that beef carpaccio dish with your bowl of pho, you kind of just look at it like, wow, this is tau pho thai ring, but with all the condiments and stuff, but I kind of made it into a goi. Like a beef carpaccio boy,
Man, I gotta tell you, so far, talking to you about food is so nah to me.
Yeah. No, like just being hungry too. Like,
It gives me so much joy to really get into the... Because, you know, like, I think about these a lot and I talk to a lot of chefs and But then every time I talk to a new chef, there's like different these ideas, little different ideas.
Different ideas, different philosophies.
Yes.
Their background, their upbringing, their training will give them a different approach and a different perspective into the cuisine. You know, so for example, if you speak to Yuen or Duen or Nguyen, they'll probably have a different perspective on, you know, the things we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
did you get to hang out with those two at the party?
Nguyen. Yes, and then Duen, she came when, or we got to say hi when I was on my way out, and then I think we're gonna connect next Tuesday with a bunch of other chefs in the industry in LA.
Yeah, I'm transitioning into this conversation because how much of this community of chef influencers are tight, are connected?
I don't know, to be honest. Like, I think everybody keeps to themselves, but in terms of me, at least, I'm trying to be involved in the community.
Yeah.
So I do try to make time for example, the party, or when Duen hit me up 2 days ago or yesterday, you know, even though I had something on my schedule, I'm like, you know, that can be put aside. I think the connection and the networking is more important than, you know, whatever I had going on. But I try to, and within the chef or food content creator community, or the Vietnamese food content creator community, so far, it's just me and Tuy, and then that are in touch with each other. Like, we keep in touch. But for other Vietnamese food content creators, they're in their own world, and you know, doing their own thing.
We should definitely change this somehow. And I mean, not like right now come up with a plan, but I'm just saying as a general force in the world of food, and I'm going to ask you a question. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm going to ask you a question in a little bit. But it should be some intention behind bringing all of it together, because there's going to be strength in numbers.
Yeah.
And I don't think that anybody's staying away from each other because they're like competing. Yeah. I just don't think that there's this awareness that, you know, so now I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you amplify some food, Vietnamese food content creators right now with me and talk about some of them that you respect the work? And I can prime you. I could share with you
a couple names.
Yeah, a couple names. And then hopefully that gets this conversation going, because we're in this space right now.
Yeah.
There's this one, she's a female. She's got over 1 million followers, but when she makes her thing, she talks like, she throws in sexual innuendos. She talks like she's from the hood. She's just a really funny, I don't remember her name, but I just see it every now and then. And my cousin, you know, recently said that she follows this woman. I wish I do. We'll probably go back.
I think I know who you're talking about. And I think Julia brought it up recently.
She's hilarious.
Yeah. I'm going to keep my comments to myself because I'm not familiar. Or like...
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with her content yet. But I'll check her out.
Yeah.
Give me another example.
And then I'll... Well, Julia from Share My Roots. You know, she's somebody. So, I mean, when it comes to content creation... For food, it's you, Tway, Julia. See, and this is
there's another, and it's like all over, right? There is Newt Nguyen. He's Vietnamese, huge platform, but his food varies, you know, and he's more on the entertainment side. If you count home cooks too, there's
home
like
cooks
Alyssa.
Too.
Who's also from Orange County. Her tag is Gaming Foodies.
Okay.
There's Jen Dao. There's Quang out in Canada. There's a good number of Vietnamese food content creators. There's, I would say, a sizable amount. Yeah.
20, 30 out there?
I could probably, if I really thought about it, I could probably name over 10 to 15.
Okay.
Yeah.
I bring that up because at some point, it's not a saturation that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
But at some point, where is that next point of evolution for all 20, 30 of you, right?
It's different because at the end of the day, it's like you have to ask each one is like what their goal is in the industry. Like, what are they trying to do with their platform? You know, because some of the food content creators aren't trying to open a brick and mortar.
Yeah.
They're not trying to, I don't know, everybody has a different purpose.
Philosophy,
A different philosophy. Not everybody is a cook. You know, most of the food content creators are...
Home cooks.
Home cooks, yeah. Or if any, just enthusiasts, you know? So it's, it really varies, depends. The situation and their goals and desire.
And I ask this because I always want to see something, you know, a future goalpost elevating what we do, because this will probably go on for a few more years until that one person goes, I got it. I'm going to do I'm just using it as an analogy, right? I'm going to go in the space of like really transforming this community and take it up a notch. I want to see that happen.
Yeah. I mean, it'll get there. I mean, it's always evolving. Like the content space is always evolving. There's new content creators on the scene. Like, I don't know, probably count one every year. Like, you'll get a new creator, a Vietnamese creator on the scene. Like, there will be 3 or 4 new creators on the scene a year, because people will eventually learn how to operate a camera. People will eventually learn how to shoot and share, and then decide to make content. And then, you know, if one video pop off for them, they're like, hey, this is fun and this is something I want to do. And then there's always going to be someone new. But I think the main thing is who's going to still be around?
Yeah, totally.
Who's going to still be around? Because being in this industry for the past 3 years, and 3 years is not a long time, but I've seen people come and go like that. Like, I've seen people blow up, be hot for like a couple of, I don't know, a couple of months, and then all of a sudden it gets too overwhelming, and then they just...
What makes people quit?
It's the pressure. And this is all, I'm saying it based from my
personal
experience,
yeah.
From my personal experience, but it's the pressure of always gotta, you know, you always gotta show up, you always gotta keep up the numbers because of the algorithm. Social media isn't what it was like 10 years ago, where if you have a certain amount of following, all of your audience get to see your work. Now with the algorithm, is like if your video didn't perform well, maybe 10% of your audience will see that video, and it's not going to be pushed to the other 500,000. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, and if the numbers aren't doing well, that means it doesn't, it kind of messes with your mind, and it kind of reflects on your skill and your ability to, you know, put or make relevant content. And when your numbers don't do well, the brand, it reflects on the brand deals. And like, it just multiple things that accumulates, you know. But I think all in all, I think it's the pressure of just having a large community and being responsible. And for me, at least, it's like, dang, now I have over 500,000 people on Instagram. Just not everybody is relying on me for recipes, but for the people who do save recipes and execute it on their own, now it's my responsibility to like write something that works, right? Because if I'm putting out a recipe that I wrote and somebody saves it and spend their hard-earned money and time to go to the market, spend that money on ingredients, make it, and it doesn't work,
it's on you.
It's on me.
Man, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
There's multiple levels of pressure for you because you got to deliver.
Yeah.
You have fulfillment that you have to do. And then you have to make sure that whoever's doing it at home is going to make it taste good too.
Yes. But like, that's the beauty of cooking, you know, it's like I can only share so much and as best as I can, because with food is like, even if you use a different brand of fish sauce, it could, you know, change the end result of the dish drastically. You know, if you use a tomato that's not in season, if you use a shrimp that is, or if you overcook your shrimp, like it just changed everything, you know? So that's like my leeway there.
But
at the end of the day, I have to write and make sure that recipe works, that so that if someone were to replicate that recipe, it gets to as close to that dish as possible for them.
Your pressure is very different than my pressure, but I suspect that the pressures that somebody in your position has sharpens you and makes you better. And for me, I'm just reflecting on my journey, and I just realize like I need to not be as sloppy. But my whole journey is different in that I'm out for blood.
Yeah.
I'm out for knowledge, right? But it's almost just for me, and I just happen to share it with the public, right? But you know, I've done some interviews recently where I've been called out by my very close friends, like, you could have done the research. You could have gone deeper when that person answered this way. And these were like high profile, like people. And I think that I bring this up because we as a collective group of Vietnamese people in content creation, entertainment, we have a responsibility now to not be sloppy. Right? And you're leading the pack with this idea.
Because I mean, if you do something that, I don't know, if I get canceled for something crazy, it's like it's a reflective on the Vietnamese community. And then, you know, it's that pressure as well. But it's like, if you're going to choose to do something, I guess just do it well. If you're going to choose to make pho, or if you choose to make a chicken stock, strain the stock, you know, not be so sloppy, add finesse so that people show, it shows people that you care, you know, it's just putting that care into whatever it is that you're doing, you know, but yeah, that's just my opinion.
How has this journey affected your life in the last year?
I mean, there's the good and the bad.
Can we talk about that?
All of definitely.
It? Good and the bad.
In terms of my lifestyle, I get more freedom versus being in the back of house 14-hour days, you know, working for a paycheck. Nowadays, I have more freedom and I get to do whatever I want to do whenever I want to do. So I have to have a lot of discipline and I have to self-regulate my schedule. Mental health has been, it does affect your mental health because it's all the, there will be days when, you know, people are just leaving crazy comments and
or the numbers don't hit.
Or, I mean, the numbers was like an early stage thing where like early on in my content creation journey, I focused so much on numbers because that dictates my validity or whatever, you know. But nowadays I don't take it personal because some days the video will perform, some days it won't. You just never know. And all I can do is just continue showing up, you know, or continue to put numbers out. But mental health, it does affect your mental health a lot because it's like the pressure of, you know, writing something that works for people, the pressure of continue to show up and keeping your numbers up so that, you know, my team can, you know, use those numbers to pitch for brands and to sell to brands. And I don't know, it's a lot, and it's something that I'm still learning and adjusting to. It's been 3 years, but I'm still trying to get used to this lifestyle of being a content creator. Like, I sometimes joke around with Julia saying that, man, I miss the kitchen because there's like structure.
Yeah.
There's, you know, like there's pressure, but it's good pressure. But here is like, it's nowadays is just me just regulating myself because I have so much freedom. I don't know what to do with it.
Damn, man. Are you sure you want to get into owning a restaurant?
Yeah. I mean, it's a part of my path.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it's a part of my path. But now that social media is in my life, I have to find a way to make the two work.
And you'll continue to do both?
Yeah, because it's the modern day marketing for your business.
Yeah.
You know, like I think another chef spoke about it recently where he just opened up a restaurant in Montana, but he also makes content, you know, like chefs, like in the modern world, if you do not have a social media platform or if you're not making content, you are way behind.
Yeah.
Why not put it into your P&L and, you know, use that as, because at the end of the day, it's marketing for you, right? Because nowadays, less and less people are reading newspapers. They're not reading, you know, the guidebooks. They're not watching TVs. So you have to go where the eyeballs are. Yeah. You have to go where the attention is. And the attention is in everybody's pocket, which is that piece of phone, right? So how do you get your business in front of their face? How do you make people fall in love with you? Fall in love with who you are, fall in love with the product that you put out. And then, you know, once you have that, it's like now you have people who don't know you, but they want to support you. They want to taste your food. They want to hear your story because maybe your story gives them hope, you know? So it's like that's... like me thinking like 5 years down the road is like, okay, how do I mix a brick and mortar? How do I get an operator to, you know, focus on managing the restaurant, but also handle the social media side and continue to put content out and continue to document my journey, you know?
Can you give us a little preview? Is it going to be a Vietnamese restaurant? Is it going to be locally here in Orange County, LA? Is it going to be a little bit upper, you know, fine dining with a full bar? Or is it going to be some hole in the wall done right with like 10 seats?
I mean, I can't really say much because the reason why is because I tend to, you know, well, back in the days when I was young and naive, I would like lay out my plans and tell friends like, oh, for example, like, oh, I'm going to move to Vietnam for 3 months. And then, you know, that 3 months ended up, or I mean, for 3 years and then 3 years ended up being 3 months, you know. So I'm not going to get into too much details, but it won't be fine dining to start. It won't be creative food to start because, or I'm like, when that, when the time is right, it's whatever works with the market.
This conversation gives me so much hope about the future.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you, you know, spending time in the first episode talking about the difficulties of the journey. And then this is illuminates a different part of your life. And, you know, thank you for sharing it with me.
You're welcome. No, it was really fun. I think it's something that I don't get to speak about often, is because most of the time I'm, you know, behind the camera and just sharing recipes, and I don't get to dive in and talk about, you know, my personal journey.
Yeah, so. And this is why it's so important to me. Yeah. Because I get to see the man, the woman behind the thinking of the final yeah. delivery on screen or on IG. And yeah. it's so important that we get to understand what the intentions behind these images and these videos that we're seeing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much, David.
Man, thank you for having me, and I'll be seeing you around at the next event.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.